Today we're going to talk about what I call a Roth conversion alternative. This is a way to utilize life insurance to generate some of the same benefits that a Roth would generate, primarily tax-free income in retirement. So I usually start out, I've got a whole whiteboard presentation, but because today I'm going to be combining both phase one and phase two, I'm not going to go through all the whole whiteboard presentation, but I'll just cover the principles. We'll discuss them and how I would lay this out. So I start by comparing retirement plans. Let's see, there's the mic. But,
Taggart Symposium participants, focus session number 3 will begin in 2 minutes. Begin the countdown.
Okay. There's a little bit there. I'll try to pull it up a little closer. Is that better? Okay. All right. So I start by comparing retirement plans to planting a seed while we're working so that we have a crop to harvest when we retire. Everyone with me on that concept? Age-old concept. Just not the first time any of you have heard or seen the idea of a crop and a seed for retirement plans. But then I explained that there are actually two different crops that you can grow. On one, your seed is deductible. In other words, the premium is, or the payment is pre-tax, but then your crop is all tax. The alternative is to use after-tax dollars and then have a tax-free crop. So who can give me an example of the type of plan that would follow that first path?
401k.
A 401k, perfect. I call it the alphabet soup of plans. 401k, 403b, 412e3, 457, IRAs, traditional IRAs, SEPs, simples, all of them follow that particular path. Who can tell me what the second? Well, I didn't realize it already popped up there. All right, so I feel like Jerry this morning. I give you the answer. So who can tell me what the second plan is? It's called a Roth IRA. Okay, so it's a Roth IRA. The big difference between the two is that, well, and we'll talk about why we might utilize a Roth IRA or a Roth alternative versus a traditional IRA approach. The challenge is that Roths have some significant limitations. First of all, you're limited on income. Who knows what the income limitations are for a Roth? Okay. Excellent. I was going to say the phase out starts at 184 for a married couple filing jointly, starts at 117 for a single person. So it phases out. That's the maximum income. What's the minimum income to be able to contribute to a Roth? Thank you. Someone, and forgive me. What's your name?
I'm sorry, my name is Jenny.
Yeah, you have to have earned income. You have to have earned income sufficient to cover the contribution that you're making. Then, pardon me? Earned income, that's right. You have to have at least as much earned income as the contributions you're making. So there are these limitations on income to even be able to qualify for contributions to a Roth. Many of you deal with clients that are outside of those income parameters. So a traditional Roth isn't even an option for them. But even if they fall in those narrow income parameters, what's the maximum that you can contribute per year to a Roth IRA? $5,500 plus the catch-up of $1,000 if you're over age 50. So $6,500. That's not going to grow a very big crop for many people. True. But that's still not a great crop that you can grow. But that you're right. It's $6,500 as an individual. Lastly, there are limitations on when you can take the money out of a Roth. Who knows what the limitations are for when you can take money out of a Roth?
Five years.
Okay. I heard both pieces, but I didn't hear anyone tell me the key piece between them. So the two pieces are 59 and a half or 5 years, whichever is later. So if you start a Roth IRA at age 58, you cannot take your money out tax-free without penalty at 59 and a half. You have to wait 5 years. So it is 5 years or 59 and a half, whichever is later. So the Roth alternative approach which is utilizing overfunded life insurance, and we'll get into that. But the Roth alternative has no limits on income, no limits on contributions, no limits on withdrawal. It can also self-sustain upon disability. How does it self-sustain? Waiver premium, excellent. It self-completes on death. Because if your employee, whoever is trying to save this money, happens to be at this stage in that timeline, as they're planting their seeds, and they pass away, then what do they have to pass to their posterity? Just what they've grown. Here, you get the death benefit of the life insurance policy. Additionally, the crop can be accessible for major medical conditions. And we'll talk a little bit about that piece as well. So does that make sense? The big picture, it's really that simple. Crop and seed, you have a choice between paying tax now or paying tax later. So here's my question. Which crop do you think Uncle Sam would rather have us grow? He would much rather have us grow the top one, and in fact incents us to do so by putting so many constraints on the Roth IRA. Why does he want us to grow the top one? So that's it, so that he can pull more taxes. Because when you hit age 70 and a half, what happens? RMDs. He makes you start taking contributions, taking withdrawals out of your IRA account. Why does he care if you take withdrawals out? So we can tax it. Okay? Yes, sir.
Don't you think Uncle Sam also likes getting the tax now on choose the Roth?
Well, fascinating question. In fact, I'd like to cover that in just a few minutes if I could. Because, in fact, he created what's called a Roth conversion option that is really shrewd on his part. So we'll come back to that here in just a moment. So at 70 and a half, we have to start taking out required minimum distributions. We do that because Uncle Sam wants his piece of the money. So he takes his piece, taxes, whatever that rate is. Let me ask this. Are taxes going to go up or down moving forward? Okay. I hear different answers. I submit that I guarantee taxes will go up. For whom and how high, I'm not sure. But I guarantee they'll go up because we've got a multi-trillion dollar deficit. What's the primary source of income for our country to deal with the deficit? Tax revenue. So I guarantee taxes will go up. They might not go up for Larry individually or Justin individually. They'll definitely go up for Chris and John, but I don't know who's going to pay how much, but I guarantee taxes will go up for some people because that's the only way we can deal with the deficit. But let's assume that it's, say, a 30% tax bracket. So if you've got, how much do you think most people are trying to build in that crop? If you ask your average client what their goal is to have in their IRA or their 401k at retirement, what dollar amount would come out? $1 million, right? That's, everyone in this room knows that that's not sufficient. But for most of them, that's what they would be thinking. So if they had $1 million, that means they'd be taking out $50,000, roughly, as an RMD. Everyone here knows that RMDs actually start at 3.65% and scale up because it's a divisor that decreases each year, so the percentage just increases. I use 5% as a ballpark for what RMDs would represent. So out of $1 million, you'd pull out $50,000. You'd give Uncle Sam 30% of that probably. And that's just counting, well, let's figure 30 state and federal taxes. So 30% goes out in taxes. And so you're left with $35,000, right, out of that $50,000? Well, if you don't need that for income, what happens every year? If you don't need it for income, you put it in a taxable account. That's exactly what. You don't need it for income, you put it in a taxable account. Every year it will be taxed. The interest earnings on that will be taxed. The type of tax depends on the type of instrument that you put it in. But every year that interest is going to be taxed. That's unpleasant. Okay? It actually gets worse because what happens if, what happens if Kyle and his wife pass away and Kyle has $1 million in his IRA? Where would he want that $1 million to go, Kyle?
To my children.
To your children. How many children do you have?
Just six.
Six?
Just six.
6. Wow. Good for you. Okay, well, we use two children. We have two children. So Kyle has two children. We're going to talk about why. Yeah, two that you love at least. So two that you pass it on to. So there's a difference between whether he has six children or two children in the impact of this next piece. When he passes away, and his wife passed away, they're on a trip down to, I don't know, Hawaii, and the plane crashes, and he's got $1 million in his IRA, and that $1 million passes to his two children. What happens? It's taxes, and in fact, unless they choose what's called a BDA IRA, and they take those distributions off of their own life expectancy or the life expectancy of the oldest sibling, if it's the two of them that are receiving it, unless they do that, then they both, the two children, just picked up $500,000 of taxable income. What does that do to their tax bracket? Literally, they would automatically be in the top marginal tax bracket. They'll lose 39.6 plus 3.8 for Medicare plus 0.9 because they raised they took the limit off of, so 3.8 for Obamacare and 0.9 for the Medicare plus, say, 5% for state tax, and they're going to lose roughly 50% to taxes. That's really painful. Is that what you wanted for your children?
Of course.
Did you remember to name IRS as a beneficiary on your IRA?
Of course not.
Now, why would it make a difference if it was six children instead of two children? That's right, because it spreads it out amongst more children, so that $1 million would be what, about 167 apiece, which wouldn't necessarily put them in the top marginal tax bracket depending upon what other income they were receiving. Does that make sense to everyone? So the impact is more significant with the fewer children that you might have. But that's really unpleasant. That's really nasty, in fact. Kyle hears that and goes, man, why did I save all that money all those years if all of it's going to go to Uncle Sam? But in fact, it gets a little bit worse, because when Social Security was introduced, again, there's a question about whether Social Security will be around. Here's my personal philosophy. I believe Social Security will continue to exist. It's a trust fund, literally. That's what it was a trust fund. They were taking our money and putting it in trust for the future. So I think it will continue to exist. I don't know that it will stay the same it is now. I think that particularly those that have done well and saved money will have less of a Social Security benefit than those that don't. I think it'll be more like Medicaid almost, that those who need it will have more money than those of us that might have actually planned and saved and, you know, sacrificed. But that's my... That's really it is. So that's my prediction. But when Social Security was introduced, what did they say about its taxation? There are some of you that were probably here when they said it would never be taxed. Is that true? It is no longer true. In fact, as a married couple filing jointly, if your total income exceeds $32,000, 50% of your Social Security will be subject to taxation. If it exceeds $44,000, 85% of your Social Security will be subject to taxation. That's really nasty. That's really harsh. Yes, sir?
On single, so like a widower, does that drop in half?
No, it's 20. It's the thresholds for single are 25 and 34. So 25 for 50%, 34 for 85%. Okay? So as a married couple, $32,000 and $44,000 are the thresholds for taxation of Social Security income. The only good news is this, that they only count half of your Social Security income against those thresholds. So let's pretend for a moment that you are the average American couple and that you are receiving about $3,000 a month in Social Security income. That's roughly the average Social Security income for a married couple. So that's $36,000 a year. If that's your only income, is $36,000 a year, that means 18 of it is counting against that threshold of 32 or 44. So if that's your only income, how much of your Social Security is subject to taxation?
Zero.
None of it is subject to taxation. In fact, because it's 18,000, again, half of the 36 that counts against the threshold, because it's 18,000, you could actually have another $1,000 a month of supplemental income. So you're living on essentially $4,000 a month, and because of the standard deduction and exemption that you would get on the $12,000 of other income, and because the Social Security would not be subject to taxation, your $4,000 a month is gross and net. Everyone with me? Okay? Until what happens? Until you hit, in particular, age 70 and a half, and Uncle Sam makes you take out your required minimum distribution of roughly $50,000, now what happened to the taxation of your Social Security income? It just jumped you above that 85% threshold. Do you see how shrewd that was? I'd call it insidious, but that's a little too pejorative. So I'll give them credit, and I'll just say, do you see how shrewd that was? That by building a qualified account for retirement, Uncle Sam now subjects your Social Security income to taxation. Really, really unpleasant. There, everyone's with me on how that works, okay? So let's talk, someone brought up the point of a Roth conversion. So the good news is that we've got lots of baby boomers that are just finding this out, and they aren't very happy about it. So Uncle Sam threw up his arms, and he said, all right, I give. I'll let you convert from a taxable crop to a tax-free crop. He called it a Roth conversion provision. Wasn't that nice? What's the first question you ask when Uncle Sam offers you a gift? What's the catch? How much is it going to cost me? Well, the catch was, at its most liberal, he allowed you to take that distribution, so that $1 million, over 2 years. It's no longer available. But at its most liberal point, he allowed you to take that distribution over 2 years, so you can take $500,000 a year and convert it to a Roth IRA. What happens if you pick up $500,000 of taxable income in a single year? You lose 39.6 plus 3.8 plus 0.9 plus state tax. Again, you lose roughly half of it to taxation. Lots of people did Roth conversions. Why would someone do a Roth conversion? Why would you give up half of your money to Uncle Sam up front?
You don't have to do it again.
I think their taxes are
excellent. There were really two fundamental dispositions that resulted in people doing Roth conversions. The first was they said, you know what, worst case, if I die today, I'm in the same place I would have been otherwise. Because I'd lose half of it to taxes, I'm losing half now, I'm no worse off. But if I live 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, eventually that Roth IRA might get back up to $1 million. You're with me? There was a fallacy in that reasoning. And the fallacy is this. A dollar lost to Uncle Sam is a dollar lost forever. You never get back the money that you paid in taxes, or more importantly, the earning power on the money that you paid in taxes. But that was one of the rationales. People said, hey, as long as I live, in fact, many of financial advisors did a statistical analysis and said, all right, if you live at least 16 years, then this is a good strategy for you. Go ahead and do a Roth conversion. The other reason was they said, I want control of my own money. I want to be able to control when I take money out and how much I take out. I don't want Uncle Sam to control it with RMDs. That was the other reason people did Roth conversion. So, yes, sir?
I have a client who, when the stock market took a tank,
okay.
Moved it all over at a lower basis and then came back up and all that
corona. Okay, perfect. So they offset the gain with losses in the market. That's probably, in my estimation, that would have been the most legitimate reason to do a Roth conversion at that time, because you could offset that income with other losses. So that's great. So here's the reality is that about the only people that did Roth conversions that I know of are people that I wasn't able to talk to, because there's an alternative to that. And that's what I call a Roth conversion alternative. The Roth conversion alternative is very simple. It uses what I call investment-grade life insurance. What am I talking about when I use the term investment-grade life insurance? Ah, excellent. Okay, I heard several different answers. I heard indexed UL. I think I even heard a variable. I heard a whole life. Do you know what? I'm talking about permanent life insurance without necessarily addressing exactly which instrument we would utilize. But I'm using permanent life insurance on a min non-MEC basis. Everyone in here understand what I mean when I say, can someone explain to the group? What does that mean when I say a min non-MEC?
Minimum face value and putting as much cash into it as you can without making the contract?
Perfect. That's exactly what we're talking about. We're talking about keeping the face amount as low as possible to absorb the premiums that we're putting into the policy. So that's exactly what we're talking about. Jerry mentioned it earlier. I forget whether it was this afternoon or this morning, but he talked about the same principle, shoving as much cash in as possible, but keeping it tax-free in its accumulation. Death benefit will always be tax-free, even in a MAC, but we're trying to avoid a MAC so that we have tax-free cash accumulation inside the policy. Does that make sense to everybody? So here's the net effect, and I'm looking at time. I think I'm doing fine on time. So let me switch to what I call phase two. Of the presentation. All right. So let's take a case study. We've got Richard, a married 60-year-old male, wants to retire at age 67. Is that a reasonable scenario? Okay. He makes $80,000 a year, and through hard work and scrupulous savings, has been able to build a balance of $1 million in his 401k. All right? He wants to maximize the amount of monthly spendable income he has in retirement. What are his options? Four fundamental options available to Richard. One is to take the $1 million and put it in a SPIA. Right? That's one choice. What are the downsides of putting it in a SPIA? Loss of control. It will not go up. It will not go down. It's essentially a pension plan that way. Doesn't go up or down. He has no control over the money. He's lost the $1 million.
Loss of legacy.
Excellent. Loss of legacy. I love that. Okay. So the next option.
Are you talking when he's 60 or 67?
At 67. Because at 67, he'd actually have a little bit more money than $1 million. We're going to get to that.
Okay.
Thank you. He's over 59 and a half, and I did that. I chose 60 on purpose. Thank you, Justin. So the next option, so a SPIA was something I didn't even put up here because, generally speaking, most clients are not interested in losing control of the money, not being able to turn it on, turn it off, vary the income as stream as they need. So the next option would be to put it in an asset management account, right? AUM. How many guys in here are asset managers? Fantastic. Great. Okay? So that's option A, is you put it in an asset management account. And I'm going to just go right in here. So we've got a $1 million of initial investment. I'm going to assume a growth rate of 6%. Is that reasonable, you asset managers? Is that reasonable?
Yes.
Okay. So investment will, by age 67, will have grown to $1.5 million. Everyone with me? So, someone, one of you guys that's got a future value calculator, pull out and check my math, please. Verify that at 6%, $1 million will have grown to 1.5. So now he hits retirement at 67, and as an asset manager, you have to tell him how much he can withdraw from that $1.5 million account each year. You're with me? So what do you tell him? What's a safe withdrawal rate for him to pull that money out and have a high degree of confidence that it will last the rest of his life? Okay, thank you, and that's exactly what I expected, about as many different answers as we have people in here. 4% used to be what we would consider a safe withdrawal rate. Everyone's seen the new white papers that have come out, the new Monte Carlo analyses that say somewhere between 2.5 and 2.8. is probably the close, the more accurate safe withdrawal rate. In fact, the latest one showed that I saw showed 2.8 with a 90% probability of the money lasting for at least 30 years. And that was based on a 60-40.
Those are all inflation.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, fair enough. So we're going to use 4% in this scenario, which is probably a little aggressive. Everyone could give me that. The 4% is probably a little aggressive, but 4% on $1.5 billion is how much in annual income? $60,000. So we take their Social Security of 36 and their annual income of 60,000 gives them a total income of 96,000. Take out taxes and we're left with a net income of 68,922. Everyone's with me. That's what they have to spend in retirement at a aggressive withdrawal rate. And some might say an aggressive interest rate, but whatever. We're just going to call 6 reasonable. But an aggressive withdrawal rate means they're going to net $68,000 of income. Everyone with me on that piece? Okay. So option B, so option 1 or option 0 was a SPIA, and I'm not going to go into that one. Option A was the AUM account. What's the next? I should have waited. All right, I'm going to go back. Okay, you didn't see that one. You didn't see that one. What's your next option for providing income for these clients in retirement? Richard, what's the other option? An income annuity, right? Is that a variable annuity? Indexed annuity? I don't know. Doesn't matter. Okay, whatever it is, it's an income annuity, a deferred income annuity as opposed to a SPIA. So I'm going to assume that we've got a guaranteed growth rate of 7% on that deferred income annuity. Okay? Is that reasonable?
No.
Okay.
I like one.
Okay. Pretty aggressive, right? Pretty aggressive. Assuming 7%. But assuming 7%, that means the account will have grown to 1.6. Did someone else check my math already on the 1.5? Okay. So at 7%, it will have grown to $1.6 million over those 7 years. I'm going to assume a withdrawal rate, a guaranteed withdrawal rate, of 5%. Is that reasonable? Okay. That's probably reasonable. On a deferred income annuity, if it's a variable annuity, you could probably get a guaranteed growth rate today of, what, 6% as a guaranteed for an income purposes, not the performance inside the VA. It's a whole other issue, but for income purposes, we could probably get a guarantee of about 6% and a withdrawal rate of 5%. Okay.
Talking about lifetime income.
Yes. That's exactly what I'm talking about. Thank you for that clarification.
I'd say it's probably more around 4%.
As the withdrawal rate.
Unless you're older.
No, at 65, they're all about 5%.
It depends on whether we're doing single or joint life. That fair enough. I'm assuming a single life here for Richard. Again, some liabilities to that. But what I hope you guys are seeing is that my numbers here are aggressive, if anything. Is that fair? Okay. So he takes his expected withdrawal rate of 5% on the $1.6 million, gives him $80,000 now of annual income. Add that to his Social Security, his total income is 116. Everyone's with me? Minus taxes, and I left taxes at the same rate, 25 and 5, gives him $33,000 in taxes and a net annual income of 83. Is there everyone with me on how we reach that? Any questions on those first two options? How those came about? And whether those are realistic, conservative, aggressive, everyone with those numbers, with me on the numbers. Option C is what I call a Roth conversion alternative. We take the $1 million, we're assuming the same growth rate at 6% that we did on the investment, the original investment income. So and we're going to take $223 per year out for the next 5 years. Everyone with me on that? It's the $1 million taken out over 5 years with 6% rate of return on what wasn't taken out. And that's why we get 223 instead of 200. Any questions on that?
Starting at 67.
Well, no, we're starting at 60. Starting immediately, we take 223 out per year. We pay taxes on the withdrawals. Now, if I take 223 out instead of 80,000 out, what's that going to do to my tax rate? It's going to go up. So you see, I raised it from 25 and 5 to 33 and 5. Everyone's with me, okay? So that's 85,000 on the 223, which nets me 138,854. Everyone's with me there. We take that 138,854 and we put it in an overfunded, and in this particular case, I used an overfunded IUL. Could we use an overfunded whole life? Absolutely. Could we use an overfunded VUL? Absolutely. The specific instrument is less important than the fact that we're putting that wrapper of life insurance around it, because that wrapper of life insurance now says that it would generate an income of $57,000 from the life insurance policy. Everyone's with me. At age 67, we'll generate $57,000 for the rest of their life, for the rest of Richard's life. Add that to his Social Security income of 36, means that he has a gross income of $93,647. Everyone's with me on my math. How much do they pay in taxes? How much of the Social Security is taxed? Goose. How much of the life insurance distribution is taxed? Zero. So the 93 is net, and it's also gross. Everyone's with me on that. So now we come back to the three options. The first one generated 68 of net income. The second one generated 83 of net income. This one generates 93 of net income.
Hey, Lauren, can you take a minute and go back? I'm lost on the 57,647.
Okay.
Maybe I'm the only one in here that is, but
no, and that's
since I paid my money, I want to know.
Thanks, Justin. The 57, the 57 is from the illustration that you don't see. That's why you're lost, because it's an IUL. I put in 138.
You're pulling it out annually for 7 years?
I pull it out for 5 years. I pull out 223 for 5 years.
And you're investing.
I pay the tax.
And at the end of that time, it's grown to a sum large enough to produce 57?
Precisely. That's exactly, starting at age 67. Which is when all the rest. That's right.
That's based on 7% return.
In fact, candidly, it's been a couple of years since I ran the illustration. I'm not sure exactly which rate I used, but that's a great question, and I want to touch on that in just a moment. But first of all, have I answered your question, Justin? That's we put 138 in premium for 5 years into the policy. It grew. And now we're taking distributions out of the policy as loans on the back end. So when we're...
I was thinking of the annuity. That's where you said...
Okay, thank you. So let's talk about IUL for just a minute, because that's what I used for this.
The question I have is, you got 93,000 total with this last alternative. And did I get that right, that the previous illustration should pay 3? So we're talking $10,000 difference, okay? So how much is $10,000 sensitivity worth in comparison to the fact that I can absolutely take the option B to the bank and know
okay.
I'm going to have that, and the other one is maybe a mystery?
Yeah, fair enough. And in fact, that kind of segues back to the very same question that I was going to answer about the probability of generating the $57,000. Because that's really what you're saying. You're saying, I'm giving up a guarantee, because that 83 was guaranteed through the income rider on that variable annuity or indexed annuity. So it was guaranteed. This 93 is not, because it's based on an assumption inside the indexed universal life policy. So for just a minute, and it really wasn't necessarily my intention today, but we've got a few minutes, so I'll cover it. Let's talk about indexed universal life insurance and how I believe, at least, it is, since this is my presentation, you have to hear my philosophy, at least, on how indexed universal life should be illustrated. How many of you are familiar with AG 49? How many of you have heard of that? Actuarial Guideline 49. Set some arbitrary limits on the maximum illustrated rate for life insurance, indexed universal life insurance. What are, JR, I see you nodding your head. Do you know offhand what they are? Do you want me to go into them?
I just know they exist.
Okay. Anybody know what the arbitrary limits for under AG 4, Actuarial Guideline 49, introduced this year? This is the first year that it came out. Started back in April with the limitations on the maximum illustrated rate for indexed universal life insurance. Anybody remember what it's based on?
Didn't they take that from 1958 or something till the present and do a daily compounding? And then they came up with a high value and a low value and a miss of the midpoint.
Okay, very, very close. Very, very close. In fact, what they did was they said every indexed universal life insurance company is required now, when they establish and put out their illustration software or put out an illustration, they're required to set the maximum illustrated rate based upon their specific indexing strategy with its cap and floor, or if it's an uncapped strategy with a participation rate, or if it's spread strategy. It's based upon the annual S&P 500 point-to-point product for that insurance carrier. Annual point-to-point S&P 500. So whatever their annual point-to-point S&P 500 product has for its cap and floor, they go back to 1950. 65 years was where this started. And in fact, that's what it will continue to be. It won't always go back to 50. It'll go back 65 years. So we drop off 1950 next year. It'll be 51 forward. So they go back 65 years. And whatever, on a daily rolling basis, whatever the average performance of their indexing strategy on the S&P 500 annual point-to-point product, whatever that average performance is, that becomes their maximum illustrated rate. Now, there were a couple of other little caveats that I'm not going to get into about their options budget. That, you know, Jerry talked a little about that this morning, but fundamentally, most carriers are limited in their maximum illustrated rate to what represents the average performance of that product going back 65 years on their annual S&P 500 point-to-point. Is everyone with me on what AG 49 limits? So that is the maximum illustrated rate. Now, let's pretend I'm looking for someone that might represent a different carrier in here. Let's pretend that is anyone here Pac Life? Anyone here from Pac Life? Anybody seen Pac Life? Let's pretend that it's Pac Life and they have an international indexing strategy. Do they get to use the 65-year performance of their international indexing strategy to determine the maximum illustrated rate?
No.
No. It's based on their S&P 500 annual point-to-point product. In my estimation, that was one of the great weaknesses of AG 49. It is not indexing strategy specific. It's a carte blanche based upon their S&P 500 annual point-to-point product. So the actual performance of that international indexing strategy might be greater or less than what their S&P 500 product does. That's what I feel the first weakness was in AG 49. The second, I think, is more significant. That maximum illustrated rate represents what? The average performance of that product. By definition, that's the 50th percentile. That means your client, if I'm illustrating at the maximum illustrated rate on an IUL product, I'm illustrating a 50% chance of success for my clients. Historically, and again, we know that past performance doesn't guarantee, you know, future past results don't guarantee future performance, but if the next, and it's on a 25-year rolling period, I didn't clarify that, it's a 25-year rolling period, so if the next 25 years, our average in the industry, you know, since out of the 65, then I've got a 50% chance that that's what it's going to be. I don't know about you guys. I am not comfortable meeting with a client and saying, you're going to have, what was it, $57,000, and you've got about a 50% chance that that's what your income is going to look like in retirement. How many of you think your clients would say, okay, that sounds good? Okay? My preference is to illustrate each specific product based on its index strategy. And again, there are lots, there are as many different indexing strategies out there as we have people in the room. There are S&P 500, there are Russell 2000, there are international indices, there are spread strategies. There are as many different indexing strategies as we have people in the room. So my preference is to go back and determine what the 100th percentile performance of that specific indexing strategy would be. Again, going back as far back as I can and looking at the 100th percentile performance. In other words, that's the worst annual average credit for that particular product. Does everyone understand what I mean by that? 100th percentile performance means that as long as the next 20 years or 25 years, depending on which period we're using, as long as the next 20 years are no worse than the worst 20 years in the history of, of that particular product or the indices, as long as it's no worse than the worst 20-year period, then that's going to be what the performance is. We have a 100% chance that as long as the next 20 years are not worse than the worst 20 years, then we can expect that performance from the product. Now,
Or better, or
perhaps even a little bit worse, because again, there might be a sequence of returns variation in there as well. But fundamentally, once we go back that far, we're looking at daily rolling periods. We've got over 13,000 data points in there. I think that's a very realistic expectation. I'm very comfortable sitting down with a client and saying, the 100th percentile performance of this product is whatever that is, and it's going to be different for every single indexing strategy that's out there. Does that make sense to everybody?
But it's going to be about in the 4.5% to 5% range, right?
Actually, some of them will. Many of them will. Some of them will not. Some of them will come in at 6%. And I've actually got software that I use to analyze each indexing strategy and determine what its 100th percentile performance is. There are three indexing strategies out there that have a 100th percentile in excess of 7%. Three of them. Again, I don't work for any of these companies. I just do the analysis, and I look at their indexing strategies. One is Columbus. Columbus has a very unique spread strategy where they give the client the first 7% of index performance. It's an annual S&P 500. They give the client the first 7%. They take a spread of 5%. And it's uncapped above that. The uncapped nature of that particular product makes it very impressive. Its 100th percentile performance historically, I actually had their actuaries run internally what their 100th percentile performance was, and they sent it to me. Comes in at 8.12% was their 100th percentile performance on that spread strategy. I wouldn't, zero floor. Now, interestingly, their maximum illustrated rate based upon their S&P 500 product is today, I think, 7.26, something, I think I'm very close, 7.26. So I can't even illustrate 8.12 because I'm limited by AG 49 to illustrating 7.26. But can I sit down with a client and now I can say, even if the next 20 years are worse than the worst 20 years in the history of in the last 65 years, then this is still a very realistic rate of return, a really very realistic performance that we could expect from this product. Does that make sense to everybody? Yes, sir.
Just a comment. I really like your presentation because it takes a little bit different look than maybe what people have been told in the past, which is, you know, defer your taxes,
until later, you'll be in a lower income tax bracket without really looking at the effect on Social Security and taxes or even the cost of Medicare and things of that nature. So, you know, I think whether it's a Roth or this alternative, it makes a lot of sense.
Thank you for your kindness. In fact, I see a couple of questions, but I would submit that particularly with the new Department of Labor ruling coming out about best interest standard, I would submit that any financial advisor who is not addressing the tax implications for their clients in retirement is at risk. Now, this isn't the only way to address tax implications, but I would submit that anyone who is not addressing the tax implications on their retirement income is at risk under the best interest standard. Because if all I do is grow their assets and yet they're going to have less net income, I mean, that's a significant difference. We're talking about almost $30,000 difference, $2,000 a month difference in spendable income in retirement. Do you think your clients care about that? If they don't, let me know, because I'd love to talk to them, because they have lots of things. So I would submit that failure to address the tax implications of their retirement income strategy is not in their best interest. So thank you. I saw two other questions.
Yes. May we assume that the 57,647 is then above what we would have illustrated under this new calculation?
No. In fact, it was illustrated
in conformity to?
Yes.
Okay.
It would have been. And in fact, for this particular indexing strategy, that product, it was about the 125th percentile, because again, like Columbus, it was its 100th percentile comes in at 8.28.
The other two facets I wanted to ask, one was, do we assume that the 57,647 will go like that to in perpetuity as we would in these others?
Correct.
So we're saying to at least age 100 or something?
Age 100, age 121.
Okay.
Again, different carriers, and it's fascinating. It's one of the benefits of having the objectivity of representing whatever carrier is going to be the best solution for your client.
Last part of that question, do we assume that the loan values that are coming out to generate the 57 are at a contractual zero or something that it will not put them in jeopardy to any fluctuation?
Perfect. Thank you. In fact, this has a guaranteed loan rate that is fixed for the lifetime of the contract, if that's what you elect. So that's a great question. And there are lots of different ways to address it. Interestingly, that was the second phase of AG 49, only because Axane took me there, I'll answer that. The second phase of AG 49 limits all IUL carriers, doesn't matter who they are all limited to a maximum arbitrage of 1% on their index performance versus their loan rate. So for example, if a carrier has a guaranteed loan rate of 6%, but their maximum illustrated rate is 7.26, say a Columbus, for example, they cannot even illustrate 7.26 as the performance of that product once you're taking loans out of it. They're limited to illustrating 7% as the performance of that product. Does that make sense to everyone? Okay. Yes, sir.
I find that in the rescue work that I do with my clients, that a lot of the clients are reticent to pay the amount of tax you're suggesting they do, even over a five-year period. So reality would dictate, this is based on personal experience with clients, quite frankly, is a prudent advisor would suggest probably more than one contract with a different insurance, naive.
Well,
because
clients
want to be diversified, not only by type of insurance company, by type of asset class and investment, and they want to have some liquidity, and they can have the tax-exempt bond fund linked with their checking account.
Okay, thank you. I would submit that if you tell a client that they should put all of their money in this particular strategy, not only are you unrealistic, you're negligent. Negligent, because putting all of your eggs in one basket is fundamentally unwise. So, in fact, there are a couple of other questions, but I want to touch on that for just a minute. Because I would submit that at a minimum, roughly $250,000 should be left outside of this strategy. Because if they have $250,000 outside of the strategy and they hit 70 and a half and have to pull out an RMD on that $250,000, guess how much that RMD is? It's about $12,000, okay? In fact, it'll scale up, but it will keep them. Remember, we talked about $36,000 of Social Security income and how if we had $12,000 of additional income, it would not be subject to taxation, nor would Social Security be subject to taxation, nor would the income generated from the life insurance policy be subject to taxation. So they would be able to have that diversification, and whether it's in a real estate type fund, whether it's in muni bonds, whether it's in AUM, doesn't matter really, because that income that's generated, again, the RMD on that income will still keep them below the threshold of taxation on their Social Security income. So this is not the only solution. And in fact, it is not a solution that should be used for everyone, shouldn't be used in every situation. But to your point, I have presented this hundreds of times. My success rate is about 96% in getting clients to move forward with this type of a strategy. So if they understand what it does, they can really appreciate it, particularly the tax implications. Go ahead.
Can I just ask where the stamp is in the room?
Oh, thank you. I have no idea. That's a great question. Greg, do you have
it? Not had the stamp.
Oh, all right. So apparently it went to you guys were Kyle's unwanted children. So you didn't get the stamp. All right, ma'am, you had a question.
To ask this question, but just being in the business, it seems like a lot of people go toward the IUL as that is the saving grace, and it seems like it makes this look beautiful when you use an IUL.
Okay.
If you want to be very risk averse and conservative, what do these numbers look like when you throw a whole life at it?
Fantastic question, because again, I said at the beginning, it doesn't matter which instruments you use, whether it's whole life, IUL, VUL, they all have that wrapper that provides tax-free income from that on that distribution. So if we used whole life, let me ask, JR, can you give me an approximation ballpark? I've actually run some whole life on this, and the best I was able to come up with was about $45,000 of tax-free income in retirement. And that I had to really manipulate. You guys know whole life is it's a little more challenging to manipulate. But I could generate about $45,000 for the whole life policy.
So the reason for that is the spread on the loans that the IUL allows you to do. Because it's a wash loan on the whole life, there is no spread. And so you can't use the positive arbitrage or the leverage of that loan as aggressively. So, but this gentleman made a comment on at that point would be very true is what is our difference between option B and option C at that point?
And let me be clear, I'm not saying that this is the only thing that you should do. I'm saying it's an alternative and can be a very exciting, impressive solution for a client. Interestingly, if they only have $250,000 in qualified assets, this solution is roughly negligible because their tax implication on taking a distribution of $250,000 and 36 of Social Security, it's a wash. So it really doesn't provide any significant benefit.
So maybe a death benefit.
Correct, a death benefit. And I did mention at the very beginning that the death benefit in these designs, I always design them so that we have that available for a living benefit as well. And again, Jerry Barlman talked a little this morning about accessing it for if you're unable to perform two of your six activities of daily living, has a chronic acceleration feature to it.
Not only with the death benefit, if you believe taxes are going to go up, and then you've got the tax to grow within the whole life policy that you can use. But again, the loan rate on that to keep that policy in force, so it's not a match. But just a comment on the muni bonds. The muni bonds do hit, you know,
taxation of Social Security. That's yeah. I didn't want to call you on it. But. Okay, so we're almost out of time. Yes, sir.
Yeah, quick question. You said the top three indexes you found. Columbus was number one. What's two and three?
Well, actually, Columbus is number one. The number one is actually Voya. It's Voya's IUL. I talked about Columbus's strategy. Columbus is number two. Voya has an international set of indices with an uncapped strategy. They use the Hang Seng, the Euro Stoxx 50, S&P 500. Bottom line is it has a 100th percentile of about 8.28. Columbus has the second best. The third best is Allianz. Allianz has their own index. It's on the BUDBI. Anybody familiar with the Barclays U.S. Dynamic Balanced Index? Because it's their own index, they have an uncapped with 145% participation rate. Historically, that comes in at 8.04 as its 100th percentile performance. Again, I had their actuaries run that for me to see what its historical 100th percentile performance was. Those are the only three IUL products I would ever illustrate at their maximum illustrated rate, because their 100th percentile actually exceeds their maximum illustrated rate. Does that make sense to everybody?
Make so, sure you have a loan interest rate that is fixed and guaranteed by contract.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed.
This strategy does not work if you have a variable loan.
And then no lapse guarantee.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And in fact, those are both built into this particular product that I use for this. Thank you very much. One last question.
Do you use the software package to
determine? Yes. Unfortunately, it's not mine. So there are two companies out that I know of that have developed software packages to analyze this. One is Voya, the old IMG, and the second is Allianz. So I think if you can get into their software, you can run that back testing analysis.
It's actually right on Allianz's website.
So, all right. Thank you all for your time and attention. I hope it was helpful.